Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Welcome back to the Stronger by Science Fireside Chat series. I am your host, Greg Knuckles, and I am joined today by a special temporary guest host, Eric Trexler. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for the opportunity. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Let's hop right into things, I reckon. So there is another podcast where my special guest host for today, Eric Trexler, hosts. I have occasionally been a guest host on said podcast. It's called the Stronger by Science podcast, and there is a good news segment that we've used at the start of several of his recent Stronger by Science podcasts. And as I understand it, there is an update to one of the prior bits of good news that you shared with the audience.
Absolutely. I like to think of myself as a journalist first, and a scientist second, and a fitness professional third. So as a journalist, I wanted to make sure we provided an update here. And one of our listeners actually sent me this update, which is pretty cool. So a while ago, I mentioned that a young woman named Eleanor Lalou, I think that's the correct pronunciation, she was running for a position in the municipal government in a town in northern France. And she has Down syndrome, and one of the reasons she wanted to run was to make sure that someone in the government there was advocating for people with a variety of disabilities. And the good news update is that she got elected, which is pretty sweet. So she's now on the municipal council there, and by all accounts, doing a terrific job.
Hell yeah, that is good to hear. All right, so if you haven't listened to a Fireside Chat before, these are kind of like off-topic Q&A type discussions. So anything is fair game other than fitness questions. So, you know, listeners send in questions or topics they'd like us to talk about. And today we have several picked out. And the one we're going to start with is a listener asked what our take is on the open science movement. Do you want to lead off?
I do, but before I get into my take on it, do you want to give the listeners a general idea of what the open science movement is?
Yeah, so the open science movement is less like an organization, I guess, and more just kind of an orientation towards how one would approach the scientific process and interact with it. So kind of the traditional process of academic science for most of the 20th century and, you know, up until today has been that basically every part of the process is kind of opaque and cordoned off. So, you know, like researchers collect data, no one sees that data except for the people who are actually writing it up and publishing it. Peer reviewers do peer reviews, but then their peer reviews aren't accessible to the readers. So, you know, only the authors know what the peer reviewers had to say. Journals are behind paywalls. So if you don't have institutional access, it's difficult to access scientific articles. And basically everything is just kind of behind paywalls or not accessible or very, very opaque. And the open science movement is kind of an effort to bring all of those things more into the open. So, you know, things like pre-registering like study methods and analysis plans beforehand so people can like go back and check like, hey, did they actually collect the data the way they said they were going to and analyze it the way they said they were going to? Another aspect is open data. So if you publish a scientific article, you have to make your data available and the code you used to statistically analyze it available. Another big thing is preprint servers. So before, so like, you know, you collect your data, you write it up, and then before you actually submit it to a journal, you basically write it up as if you are about to submit it and then upload it for free to a preprint server. So your peers in your area can have a chance to read it before it's published, give you feedback on it, etc. So basically, it's just a movement whose intention is to take a lot of the kind of cordoned off and opaque parts of the scientific process and try to make them more open and accessible and transparent.
Yeah. So when I think about the open science movement, you know, I think of really just the overall process of how peer review works. You know what I mean? And I will be transparent. My faith in the peer review process right now is at an all-time low. Within the last 2 weeks alone, I've been sent the three most ridiculous papers I've ever seen in my entire life. And the funny thing about that happening, so you sent me two of them and somebody else sent me a third. And these were papers that it was not in the fly-by-night journals that no one's ever heard of. We're talking about journals that are indexed in PubMed. And all three of these articles, I looked at the title and I said, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And then I looked at the abstract and I said, no, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And the interesting thing about all three of these papers is they were sent to me. I'm not an expert in any of those topics. And immediately I knew they were ridiculous. And they were so ridiculous that they essentially went viral. And within the 2 weeks that they were sent to me, all three of them were either retracted or the journal said, hey, we are going to retract this. We're in the process. And so I think that begs the question, if I as a non-expert took a look at the title and said, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen, what the hell did the peer review process do for those papers? You know what I mean? If it was such a ridiculous premise that it went viral because of how insane it was.
Yeah. So just for context here, you know, we're not talking something like, oh, a paper was published showing that calories actually don't matter for change in body weight or something like something that is clearly wrong. But like, you know, maybe someone just had some anomalous data that they wrote up, whatever. We're talking shit like, there's a black hole in the middle of the earth that is using like alien DNA to communicate with the DNA in our cells. And that's doing something.
Yeah.
Like, and that was completely off the wall bullshit.
And that was on PubMed, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was in a journal that is PubMed indexed. That is at least theoretically peer reviewed.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things that I find to be really troubling with the peer review process currently is, like you said, a lot of the processes are opaque and we are basically funneling the entire decision-making process down to usually two people. And, you know, you'll hear stories of researchers who tried to publish a paper eight times and then the ninth time a journal accepted it. And part of me would like to believe that that process, those eight or nine iterations of the paper, were them receiving very good, nuanced, constructive criticism, them addressing it, improving the paper, and moving on to the next journal. But part of me wonders if it's just reshuffling the deck. You know, so in psychology, they had the replication crisis, right? And part of that was, part of the reasons that some of their results weren't reproducing well and being replicated effectively was some of the studies can be done so quickly and so easily with minimal resource input that you could run an online survey, didn't get what you thought, run it again, reshuffle the deck. And in a different way, but kind of analogous way, I kind of wonder with some of these, like that when the peer review process is opaque, you can just keep reshuffling the deck of reviewers until you get the two who just can't be bothered to look at it and will just accept something like that. And it's just, yeah, I think the more eyes we can have on the process, the more open the data are, the more open that the comments from reviewers are, I think that's going to be a really positive thing, so that instead of putting all this very critical decision on the shoulders of two people that can be continuously reshuffled, we have more eyes on the situation and we can develop more of a consensus where many informed people can look at it from many different informed perspectives and say, you know, yeah, this is some really high quality work. Here are some caveats, here are some limitations. So from that perspective alone, I think there's huge benefits with the open science movement. I think having more eyes on the work and on the data will allow us to develop a better consensus and a better group understanding of exactly what those data mean and exactly what they don't mean. And I think it would help reduce ridiculous stories like the one I just told, right? Where mm-hmm. where you're just like, dude, if you ran this by people who had any interest in it and any like any perspective on this, and it was more than just like two people who just like clicked accept at 5 a.m. on the bus on their way into work, we could probably avoid some of those ridiculous situations. You know, one of the things that I think is an interesting concept is the idea of like, you know, you mentioned preprint servers, right? So you do the research work, you put it on a preprint server, and now it's accessible for free, and people can look at it and provide feedback, provide commentary. And I wonder if that process became more common and universities would actually give you credit as a researcher for publishing a good preprint. At that point, you wonder kind of what the need is for journals and for this very opaque peer review process, because the work is out there and experts can provide open commentary on it. So I think to kind of put my perspective in a nutshell, when I think of the open science movement, you can name many benefits of moving toward a more transparent process with more openness. Not to mention just the ethical consideration when someone makes a very important health-related discovery, who's allowed to learn about it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really messed up thing where it's like, I can tell by the title that there's some critical information here that's relevant to my health, but who's got $40 to drop on it?
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that's a really weird thing that paywall journals make us wrestle with. So yeah, I mean, I can think of all these different upsides in terms of the ethics and the quality of the work, and I can't really think of that many downsides in terms of shifting toward a more open perspective or an open process towards science. And so I'd like to consider myself to be a pretty open-minded guy. So my question for you is, what is the downside? Like when people take the opposite perspective, what is the most common justification for saying, no, we need to slow down this open science thing?
So there are a few things. One is a concern that I've heard that I like initially disagree with and then log on Twitter and then start agreeing with, is the idea that like if papers are too open and like the quote unquote unwashed masses have access to them, that, you know, they'll basically just do like a very poor job of interpreting those papers and wind up with bad information being disseminated. And therefore, to improve the signal to noise ratio, like you need like the quote unquote experts in the ivory towers to be the ones doing the work, be really the only ones who have access to the work, who can give the like quote unquote correct interpretation. And like I said, I do think that that's both like insulting and misguided. I do see where it's coming from though, because you know there are times where like when a new study in fitness like sports science is published, I will see some just horrendous takes on social media, or like criticisms of the paper that people wouldn't make if they understood how like data collection worked. So on one hand, I do kind of get that that potential criticism, but I think that the benefits of allowing stuff to be open still far outweigh the drawbacks. Another criticism that I've heard is that and this is like kind of a theoretical criticism for open data. The idea being that, like, if you have to make your data available when you publish your paper, someone else might be able to snag that data set, see like, oh, there is another, you know, there is another hypothesis that I could approach this data set with, and then write up those results as if this was mine and as if I collected these data. And the thing is, I'm not aware of any cases of that actually happening, of basically researchers stealing other researchers' open data. But I also feel like that would be a relatively straightforward process to address, especially if open data was the standard.
Well, because they'd have to share the data that they
correct. Yeah, yeah.
Stole.
So yeah. I think that that is a theoretical problem if you're operating in a system where a minority of journals have open data policies and the rest don't. So, you know, you could make your data publicly available and then someone else could publish from that data set in a journal where the data is not required to be publicly available. Like, that could conceivably happen. But if open data did just become the standard and someone else publishes, quote unquote, their data set, and it's identical to yours, you could be like, okay, come the fuck on. Like, I see what's going on here, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that that's a potential issue with the current system, but it wouldn't be an issue if there were systemic changes.
You know, I know that I put you in a tough spot because I asked you, it's like debate team, and mm-hmm. you got put on the debate team that you didn't necessarily agree with. So I asked you to make these arguments, but I think one of the interesting thing about those arguments is that it kind of operates under the assumption that the current system does a good job of preventing them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't, you know? So like for instance, the idea that only the you know, ivory tower expert should be, you know, handling this information and disseminating it. Well, the ivory tower said that there is a black hole in the center of the earth, but Twitter said there's not, and well, now it's retracted.
At least one person in the ivory tower.
Right,
and, but one section editor took a peek at it, said, well, this is worth sending out to reviewers. And two reviewers looked at it and said, yeah, this is cool.
Right, but like I said, that was in the period of 2 weeks, three separate papers that the ivory tower let through, and Twitter said, dude, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And then there's like, oh yeah, we can't really defend this. And then the other thing you mentioned of stealing data, I've actually seen some very fascinating stories of that happening in the peer review process. So mm-hmm. I've actually seen a number of stories. There, it's a pretty remarkable thing to do in a bad way. Like it's a pretty extreme case, so it's not like there's stories all over the place. But there have been instances where, because the process is opaque, reviewers have looked at a paper that they've been assigned to review and said, you know, this paper's so damn good, I might just make it my own. And they reject it as the reviewer, and then they steal it and publish it in a different journal. So they submit someone else's work, throw their name on it, and there have been instances where some poor researchers have been sitting in their office, they open up, you know, open up their email, and they say, wait a minute, that's my paper.
Yeah.
You know, so like the thing that I find interesting about those arguments is that it kind of assumes that the current system does a really nice job of preventing those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just not sure that it does.
No, I agree. So there are a few more criticisms of the open science movement. One of them, this next criticism isn't necessarily about like the open science movement leading to bad results and worse quality of published research, but more like researchers wanting to not have as many threats to their reputation. So one of the things with open data and open code is that if there's something wrong with your data, not necessarily saying that, you know, it's like fake data or something like that. But, you know, just simply you collected data, you had a methodology for collecting it, and maybe you just calibrated a machine poorly, you know, and now your data set's open and someone who also has expertise with the equipment you used to collect the data can look at your data and say, well, I see what happened. Like, you have some weird findings because that machine was poorly calibrated, you know. Mm-hmm. Or if you make your code public, this is something you bring up all the time. Like, there are one of the most common softwares to analyze, like to do statistical analysis in our field is SPSS. Because you don't have to write code for SPSS, like as a point and click software. And there are certain analyses that like SPSS just doesn't do, like certain interactions and post-hocs that it just can't get at. And then people will say in their statistics section, like, oh, we used SPSS and these were the results we got. And you'll just like lean over and be like, dude, look at this shit. They're saying they did this particular post hoc. They used SPSS. I know good and well SPSS won't run that post hoc test or won't make that comparison. And so the thing is, like, if code had to be open, like SPSS is point and click, but it does also spit out the code that it ran. People could look at that and say, hey, you said that you ran this post hoc and did this post hoc comparison. You literally can't do that in the software you said you used. So, you know, maybe you just misinterpreted the SPSS output. And so in a situation like that, you know, nothing nefarious is going on. Like, you miscalibrated a machine, you misunderstood a statistical output. Like, those are innocent mistakes that people make, but they would, you know, probably necessarily result in a correction. If someone could look at the code, look at the data and say, hey, there's a simple error here, you need to issue a correction. And one of the problems with the current journal system now is that issuing a correction is a huge pain in the ass. And so, like, you know, people, I think that there's a thrust to not make that stuff public, because if it was public, more corrections would just necessarily happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more work for people who end up needing to correct their papers. And also, currently, and I don't agree with this at all, but currently having to issue corrections semi-frequently is kind of seen as like a black mark on your CV, which I think is not great. So, you know, if you have to issue corrections for every paper you ever did, okay, maybe you're not a very careful scientist, and maybe that should be perceived as a bad thing. But, you know, if you have to issue a correction on one out of every five papers you published, that would be seen as an extreme rate of corrections under the current system. But also, like, that seems perfectly reasonable to me because, you know, like, people make mistakes, you know? And maybe one out of five would still be quite a bit, but even like one out of 10, that would still be seen as an extreme correction rate. And, you know, people make mistakes sometimes. And I don't think that making occasional mistakes should be penalized, but it currently kind of is in the current system. And basically, like, open data, open code, there would be way more corrections that would be issued. But the thing is, like, in other fields, that has actually been super, super important. So one example in the field of economics is a couple researchers, Reinhardt and Rogoff, published a paper basically showing that when government debt gets too high, subsequent GDP growth over, I think, the next decade was slightly negative. Like, they averaged like a 0.1, 0.2% decrease in GDP over the next decade. If memory serves, when government debt was more than 90% of GDP or something like that. And so, like, that finding kind of became the largest part of the evidentiary basis for, like, austerity projects that various governments undertook after the financial crisis. But the thing was, like, the researchers, Reinhard and Rogoff, like, they weren't acting maliciously. They're not fringe people. Like, they're big-time serious economists. And they were using an Excel sheet that their data was in. And when they did that calculation, they just simply accidentally didn't, like, drag down and select all of the rows that they were supposed to run their calculation on. So I think there were, like, 18 or so countries in their data set, and they accidentally only selected 14. And when they analyzed the data from those 14 countries, they found a slight decline in GDP if government debt was too high. And when they selected all of their data, they actually saw a 2.2% increase in economic growth over the next decade, which just, like, completely harpoons their finding. And I don't have any hot takes on government austerity. Like, I'm not an economist. But the thing was, like, literally millions of lives were affected by that finding, which was a simple error. Like, I don't think that they were acting maliciously. And people found that out way after the case. Mm-hmm. I think the original finding was in, like, 2006, 2007. People basically, like, recreated the data set and recreated the analysis in, I believe, 2013. But a lot of the austerity policies were put in place in, like, 2008, 2009. That's something that could have been found and corrected in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. if the journal that the original finding was published in had open data policies, because it was a simple Excel error, and that's all there was to it. That would have been a very momentous correction to have been made. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you know this. Statisticians follow me around in my life. Mm-hmm. There's some weird thing going on. Every person I interact with is interested in stats. So, like, I took a horseback tour through the Smoky Mountains once, mm-hmm. and the tour guide was a retired statistician. So, like, I was riding through the mountains on a horse, just talking about Bayesian statistics. Like, mm-hmm. So the reason I bring that up, the guy that I have always coached with Special Olympics is also, you guessed it, a statistician. The one lesson that he just burned into my brain was, listen, Eric, you're a careful guy, probably too careful. You should relax a little bit. But if you ever make a mistake on a project analyzing data, it's going to happen in Excel. It's the data entry. It's the data calculations before they go into the stat software. So, like, you bringing that up is like, dude, when I collaborate with somebody on a project, I send them a multiple page document telling them how to arrange the data. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, don't touch anything. Like, I'm going to handle all of any calculation. It's script based. We're not dragging and dropping, because people mess up dragging and dropping, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, that story is the most believable story I've ever heard. But it like you said, it's a great example of, if some of these processes were just more transparent, it would have been picked up like that.
Right.
You know, and could have prevented erroneous policy from being put in place, which is really crazy.
Mm-hmm. And then the last common objection that I hear to the open science movement from time to time is just that it would... So some of the open science policies would wind up being more work. So, for example, one of the things that's becoming more and more common is pre-registration of study protocols. So I mentioned that before. Basically, there are repositories where you can say, hey, we're going to do this study. This is how we're going to collect the data. This is how we're going to analyze the data, yada, yada, yada. And so then when the paper actually comes out, people can check, you know, the methods of your paper and how you analyze your data against the pre-registered protocol to see, like, hey, did you actually collect this data and analyze it the way you said you were going to? Because one of the problems with science generally is that when researchers have too much leeway about how they collect and analyze their data, they may find that, like, their primary actual hypothesis didn't pan out. Like, they didn't get the statistically significant result that they were looking for. And so, like, they find some other significant interaction in their data set, and then they write up the paper as if that secondary thing was actually what they were looking for in the first place. And like, the null finding then goes unreported. And so, you know, if you're doing a meta-analysis or like a systematic review after the fact, that that null finding isn't mentioned anywhere, but like, it, it happened, it existed. It should be included in a meta-analysis that's trying to look at all of the studies ever done on the topic, but no one knows that the study was ever done to actually look for that primary outcome that was never reported, you know? So that's one of the issues you can run into without pre-registration. Just basically, if you give people too much leeway when analyzing data, they can find a lot of shit, you know? And so one of the things with pre-registration is it is another step in the process. And there's a lot of kind of like paperwork and busy work that goes into science. You know, it's not all just you're in the lab 8 hours a day working with subjects, collecting data. Like, you have to write grants. You have to write up protocols to send to the IRB. You have to write up your results after they come in. Like, there's a lot of writing, and a lot of people don't like writing. And so if you're pre-registering a study protocol, that's one more step you have to go through before you actually begin data collection. And also, if you you can run into like some logistical issues with IRBs as well. So, you know, if you get the protocol approved and then you say, okay, like, the protocol set in stone by the IRB, they've approved it. Now we're going to write it up for like, to pre-register the protocol. If the IRB comes back, like, you know, let's say you had a training protocol and a couple of your people got hurt, and you have a very conservative IRB, and they say, hey, you know, we don't want you hurting all of these human subjects. You need to change your training program that you're using in this study. It might look sketchy to go back and register and like change your pre-registered trial protocol. And like, it would be completely innocent. Like, you're making a change that the IRB is saying you have to make, but people might look at that and say, ooh, these people are changing their pre-registered protocol. Like, are there nefarious aims here? So in all of those things, like, it's just adding another step into the process that I think a lot of people don't want to have to deal with. Another very comparable thing, and what I think is one of the coolest and best innovations in scientific publishing probably ever, is registered reports. So one of the issues I mentioned before is, I didn't mention it by name, but I alluded to it, is the concept of publication bias. And so within the current system, journals are more likely to accept basically like exciting findings, and exciting findings tend to be statistically significant findings in the direction that was hypothesized by the researchers. And so if you have positive findings like that, they just wind up being easier to get published, and like, just null results in general are harder to get published. And so what you can wind up with is basically a body of literature that is biased in the positive direction towards a particular outcome, just because the positive studies are the ones that are more likely to get published. And oftentimes, like, you mentioned psychology specifically, and I think that it's worse in psychology because the studies do tend to be a lot quicker, easier, and cheaper to run. You can wind up with a problem where null results, researchers don't even attempt to publish them in the first place because they know it's going to be a pain in the ass to get them published. Maybe they've said publicly that they believe in, you know, whatever statistically significant finding they expected to see. So like, null results might be slightly embarrassing. And so, you know, you just wind up with like a skewed body of literature with way more positive results and way fewer null results than have actually occurred. So what a registered report is instead of submitting the paper after you're done with the whole project, you know, after you've collected the data, after you've analyzed it and written it up, and then submitting it, instead of that, it's basically like pre-registration on steroids. You write up your study protocol, you write up your data analysis protocol, you submit that to a journal, and the journal says, this looks like a cool and interesting study that you've proposed. We like your methods. Your method of analysis seems sound. Regardless of what the results are, they will be useful and relevant to the people in this field who will read this journal. And then they accept your paper. And then you do the actual experiment. The data come in, you analyze them, and the paper is already accepted. So, you know, it will get sent out to reviewers again because, you know, maybe your discussion section's just batshit insane. And they're like, okay, you need to tone down the discussion. But the paper itself, in principle, is already accepted. And so if you get a null finding, it is already published. You don't have to worry about the journal rejecting it. So it helps, it helps completely eliminate the problem of positive publication bias. But again, going back to the problem people have with open science of it being more work, you know, now instead of submitting a paper once, you're submitting it twice. And I would argue that on net, registered reports actually save effort. Because basically, you're probably going to deal with fewer rejections of null findings. Like, you know, you mentioned like having to submit a paper to 8 different journals and just reshuffling until you get reviewers that are good or who like you. And when people do that, it could be nefarious. Like maybe they just did a very, very dumb, stupid study that shouldn't get published and they're just fishing for reviewers who will accept it. Or it could be that they did a very good, careful study that had null results and just like reviewers keep rejecting it because they're like, this is fucking boring. We shouldn't accept this. And so like I do think on net, it probably does save time because, you know, you get the paper accepted on the basis of the protocol itself. But it does add one more step that you have to go through before you actually begin data collection. So that's another reason that just like various steps in the process where effort is added. That is a drawback. And I mean, I don't think that that's an adequate reason to reject open science because, you know, ultimately if it's more work, but you wind up with a better body of literature, that seems like it would be worth it. But there is also kind of a lot of busy work that goes into science in the first place. And so I understand people not being super stoked about it.
Yeah, and I do know quite a few people who are editors of journals, like associate editors. And so they're the person with the job of tracking down reviewers for mm-hmm. a paper. And I would bet that, you know, despite what you mentioned in terms of reducing the number of total rejections potentially, I would bet that a lot of associate editors, they hear the idea, okay, I got to get reviewers to review the methods and then review the finished product. And they're like, absolutely not. Cause like,
yeah,
dude, every friend I know that's an associate editor, like every 6 months, they just like send out a tweet saying like, no one reviews papers anymore. they're so sad. Cause like they keep sending out all these papers to get reviewed and everyone's like, I'm not going to review that.
Yeah.
And so I bet the editors are a little bit nervous about the idea of having to get a paper reviewed twice.
Do we want to also talk about how stupid the idea of uncompensated peer review is?
Sure. I mean, it seems pretty self-explanatory, right?
Yeah, dude. So this is something that people who haven't done any science may not be acquainted with. There's a good question to ask of what do journals do? Like, what value do they add? And I can't tell that they actually do in any way whatsoever. So, you know, basically you have an editor in chief of the journal and there are associate editors or section editors. And theoretically how the process tends to work is papers are submitted. The editor in chief takes a peek and they say like, okay, like just looking at the abstract, this is a paper that like the subject is germane to the interests of this journal or it's not. And if it's not, they say, oh, well, this might be a nice paper, but submit it to another journal because this isn't really what we publish. If it is something that's, you know, within the scope of the journal, they'll send it out to an associate editor or section editor and say like, hey, this is your problem now. This kind of seems to be like, this seems like it would fit in the section that you edit. So take a look at it, see if it's worth sending out to reviewers. So the associate editor will take a peek, you know, not do a full review, but just basically determine, like, is the quality of this work worth sending out to reviewers or not? And then they find a couple of reviewers, they send it out to the reviewers, and the reviewers really do the vast majority of the work. They're supposed to essentially go through the paper with a fine-tooth comb, you know, make sure that the method section makes sense, make sure the results are reported accurately, make sure, so theoretically, a reviewer is supposed to make sure that all of the sources you cite are correct and support the points you're making. I don't think they do it most of the time.
No
cause,
way.
Because I see so many miscited papers. But that's theoretically something reviewers are supposed to do. And basically, like, a good review is supposed to take a long, long time. Basically, our job for Mass is peer reviewing papers that have already been published. And we don't write up Mass articles as if they were a peer review, but we look at them as critically as we would if we were peer reviewing them, and then, you know, try to break the study down in a way that's going to be accessible to people. I can tell you, like, every paper, reading it with that level of, like, concentration and detail, like, it takes hours.
Many hours, yeah.
And peer reviewers aren't paid. Like, that peer review is a completely uncompensated endeavor for, you know, a job that might take you 5 or 6 hours for every paper you look at, which to me is just batshit insane. And so we've talked about issues with the peer review process. If you want to check out an interesting paper, Richard Smith, who was the longtime editor of the British Medical Journal, he wrote an article called Peer Review, A Flawed Process at the Heart of Science and Journals. That's worth checking out, that goes through a lot of the issues with peer review and just, like, problems that peer reviewers miss, coming from someone who was a journal editor who relied on peer reviewers for a long, long time, saying, like, look, the peer review system doesn't work very well. And the thing is that I'm not throwing shade at reviewers here, because, like, you shouldn't expect it to work well. There's no incentives that would cause you to predict that peer review would work well. Basically, the incentive for doing good peer review is the pride of a job well done. And then the cost is tremendous opportunity cost, because the better job you do, the more time it takes, and you're not being paid for your time, and you have a lot of other shit on your plate, you know? And so, like, yeah, it's not surprising that most peer reviewers don't do a good job, kind of through no fault of their own, because why the fuck would they do a good job, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, ultimately, the peer reviewers are doing 90% of the work that the journal's doing. They're not getting fucking paid for it. And the people who are making money are, like, the actual publishers. So, you know, if you subscribe to JSCR, Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, and you see that, like, William Kramer was the longtime editor, Bill Kramer didn't get rich off of editing JSCR. Like, no journal editors get rich off of editing their journals. Like, a lot of them are uncompensated, and the ones that are compensated aren't compensated much. Like, Wolters Kluwer is the publisher for JSCR. Wolters Kluwer is making the fucking bank off of it. And so, like, you know, not just the reviewers, like, the editors also aren't getting paid much, if any. There are copy editors that get paid, which, you know, is why you don't see, like, that many typos in journals. but yeah, like, there are copy editors and typesetters that get paid. Most other people who are doing the vast majority of work in the process don't see a fucking dime for it. And so, like, yeah, no shit, peer review doesn't do a good job. Do you want to go through some of the things people will say, like, to argue against compensating peer reviewers? Because in my opinion, this is the funniest shit.
Yeah, let's go for it. So one of the criticisms I've heard or the argument against compensating reviewers is it's just simply too sweet of a gig. So if you compensate reviews for these papers, then people are going to take on a ton of reviews and do a terrible job so that they can make more money and just do a bunch of very superficial reviews. They're going to be laughing all the way to the bank because of the scheme they've got going on, and there is no way to possibly handle that or deal with it or reduce its likelihood of happening. That's the one that I've heard that is pretty wild, because like Greg, you know, we operate in the real world. Mm-hmm. We have a business. When's the last time you thought, you know, we need the service done, but if we pay someone to do it, I think they're going to do a way worse job.
Yeah, they'll do a worse job if we pay them for it. And we as intellectual dumbasses could not possibly ascertain whether they did a good or bad job. And if they do a bad job, we will have absolutely no choice but to continue to hire them to keep performing that service over and over again. Like, dude, that's not how any of this works.
Yeah, the response to that potential issue is literally as simple as set a price point that makes any sense at all and just make sure they did a good job. Someone already has to do that.
Yeah.
Like, you already have an editor who's determining if they did a good job or not. If you find someone who's taking on a ton of reviews and doing an awful job, you just flag them in the system and say, hey, don't send them papers anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have someone who is accepting every review that comes across their desk, getting paid for it, and doing a really, really good job, like, cool, let that person get fucking paid, you know? Yeah. You'll wind up with a system where a disproportionate number of the reviews are going to people who do a disproportionately good job of reviewing papers. Oh, what a fucking problem. You know what I mean? Like, dude, it's ridiculous too, because I know we've mentioned this on the podcast before, but scientific publishing is such a racket. Like, it's a system where the people who do virtually all of the work don't get paid for it, but they're kind of like peer pressured into doing it because, you know, like theoretically it looks good on your CV if you've done a lot of reviews. It looks really good on your CV if you've been an editor or associate editor for a journal. Like, that's part of like the service requirement that comes along with most academic jobs. So you're not being forced to peer review and you're not being forced to be a journal editor, but like there are ways that you're strongly cajoled into performing a lot of unpaid labor in the publication system. And so the people doing virtually all of the work aren't getting paid a cent for it, and the people who actually own the journals are working with absurd profit margins. So like Elsevier's profit margin is close to 40%. Springer Nature's profit margin is like north of 35%. Taylor and Francis 30% plus. Wolters Kluwer 30% plus. Like, all of the major publishers have very, very, very comfortable profit margins. And the thing is, like, they're making enough money to pay reviewers. Like, they could put more into the system. So here's the problem with, like, journals primarily being for-profit enterprises. Like, if they were basically being run as services, which is how it used to be, actually. So if you go through the history of scientific publishing, what used to be the case is that basically scholastic societies would say like, hey, we're interested in physics and, you know, we're going to put out a journal that details findings that our society members have made. We're not going to run it for profit, or like if there is profit, there's not going to be much. And then this dude named Robert Maxwell, who is just like an all-time piece of shit. He had already like made a fortune in magazine publishing and was basically just like, what if I used this exact same model, but all of my workers were dumbass academics who didn't expect to get paid, and I could like peer pressure them into doing all of this work for free, and basically use the increasingly less profitable magazine model to make bank off of these dumbass academics that don't understand how the real world works. And like, very, very cynical move, worked like a fucking charm. He built an empire off of it. He made a ton of money from it. Other people said, wow, Maxwell's model works really, really well. We're going to do the exact same thing. And like, you know, so in the span of a couple decades, these people who like didn't actually care about science realized that they can make a quick buck off of completely changing how publishing works. They did it. And like, now that is by far the dominant model in the market.
You explained this to me a few weeks ago, and I was stunned at the time frame in which it occurred. About when did this transition occur?
I'm pretty sure it was like immediately post-war.
Yeah.
And, so people act like, you know, public is, if you talk to any researcher, they do have complaints about the publication system. No one likes it. But they're like, you know, this is just the way things are. It's the way it's always been. And it's like, nah, dude, like that's not how things were up until World War II. And then like immediately post World War II, people said, let's make bank on this. And it just completely changed the way that publishing worked.
Yeah, because, you know, I was in academia and everybody would complain about it, but everybody would say, well, it's just always been this way and there couldn't possibly be a different way.
Yeah.
I would have thought that that was the system that has literally existed since the dawn of time.
No.
I had no idea. But, you know, there is a little anecdote that kind of puts all of these topics together. So a couple months ago for Mass, I was reviewing a paper. It was a meta-analysis. And one of the cool things about meta-analyses is the data are more or less open whether you want them to be or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like we talked about having open data sets for original studies. Well, with a meta-analysis, your data is the published literature. So it's open, right? And so you and I, we work together most days. We were sitting at the computer and I was like, I literally opened it for the first time. I was like, check out this error. You know what I mean? Like 30 seconds into opening the paper. And so looked into it. Of course, it was an error. It was a huge error that just screamed and jumped off the page. And it was a journal that actually publishes the reviews. Open mm-hmm. access. So it is kind of a step toward that open science model. You can actually read the reviews. You don't know who wrote them, but you can see what the reviewer said. And dude, like two out of the three reviews were a sentence.
Ooh.
I mean, a sentence or a couple sentences.
Ooh.
Not a single comment about the methodology, not a single question. Hey, how come, what happened there? You know, like,
yeah.
And if you had ever seen a forest plot or a funnel plot in your entire life and considered what it was telling you,
mm-hmm.
the first thing with the review is you'd probably like, honestly, you'd probably email the editor and be like, come on, why'd you send this to me?
Yeah.
But at the very least in the review, you say, what in the world happened here?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a perfect microcosm of the fact that open science matters and allows us to detect errors that might cause us to make inaccurate conclusions. But right now, the safeguards in the peer review process are not there. The yeah. reviews we're getting are not adequate. And why would they be?
I mean, there's also the question, now we're getting into the topic of like predatory journals. There's also the question of whether those reviews actually happened. Because, you know, it very well could be that the journal did not send it out to any reviewers and they just like, you know, the associate editor just typed up like two sentence reviews. Like, I'm not saying that happened, but
I think
that does occur. Like, that's what predatory journals are. They claim to be peer reviewed. They're not actually peer reviewed. Like, you submit a paper, you pay the author fee, and then a week later you say like, or like the journal will email you, say, hey, we sent it out to reviewers. The reviewers said, this was tip-top work. Your paper has been accepted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that does also happen.
Yeah, based on the reviews, these reviews definitely happened. But you could tell it was one of those things where it's like, you know, we've sent an email out to a bunch of people. They all declined.
Mm-hmm.
We found someone to say yes. That person who said yes. Dude, academics, they work hard.
Yeah.
So this is a person working 70-hour weeks just trying to, you know, just trying to make it in the academic world. And on top of their 70-hour week, we've asked them to very thoroughly review this and look for every possible error that could exist and sign off on it. And they probably did it at 5 in the morning or 1 in the morning or, you know, 11 p.m. after they put their kids to bed. And it just, it was like, yeah, it was like a sentence or two, just like, hey, I guess it's fine. You know, so it's an issue that I think open science would certainly help with.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been playing the con position on this so far. You talked about some benefits. You asked me to talk about issues that people have with it. I think it should be clear. I think that the problems posed by open science are so much smaller than the benefits you actually gain from open science. I think that a lot of the reason why science isn't more open, I think there's a lot of institutional inertia. You know, people have been operating in the sciences in a particular way for the last 30 years, and a seismic shift towards open science would, you know, basically force them to change a lot about how they do things. And I think that a lot of the older people, not necessarily like trying to be ageist about this, but they're the ones who have more experience within the current system. And it would be like, and they're the ones who tend to have the most like institutional power. And so I think that there's a fair amount of inertia from kind of more experienced academics who don't want to make these shifts. I think to some degree, the reluctance towards shifting to open science might be driven by fear almost. This is something we've talked about before. Like, it's pretty uncommon that like a data set is perfectly clean, that like every last instance of data collection went perfectly smoothly. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people just, I think that there's a lot of, not the bystander effect. What's it called when basically you think everyone is better than you? The imposter
syndrome. Yeah.
I think that there's a fair amount of imposter syndrome where, you know, people are doing generally good work and their data set is like 95% good, but like they know that like, you know, maybe there were a couple errors in data collection, like maybe I have some missing data and I don't want to put my data set out there because, you know, then I will be the emperor without clothes and people will see that this data is not as clean as I could make it look in my results section. And they don't realize that like everyone's data would pretty much look like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's some resistance, especially towards open data for that reason.
Well, in one comment there, you mentioned there might be errors in the data collection, but also like consider this. If you listen to this podcast, you probably lift. Have you ever misgrooved a rep?
Yeah.
Do you think that completely untrained people are more likely to misgroove a rep? And if your outcome is reps to fatigue and they had three left, but they misgrooved one really bad, set's over.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like the idea that there's noise in a data set isn't just, oh, we botched it and the machine malfunctioned. That certainly happens. But yeah, I mean, dude, people misgroove reps and sometimes it's during the testing visit.
Right.
And like that shit you got to deal with.
Yeah. And it is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
I think the benefits of open science are enormously larger than the drawbacks to it. I think that the current system is, I wouldn't say completely broken beyond repair, but I think that it is incredibly easy to conceive of a publication system that would just be better, way better, on every conceivable level. And I think that just institutional inertia is the main thing holding us back right now.
Yeah. And there is an organization called STORC that's kind of leading the charge, pushing more people in the field of exercise science and kinesiology toward more of these open science methods.
Yeah, it stands for Society for Transparency, Openness, and Replication in Kinesiology.
Yeah, so I think the good news is, you know, we've just spent an hour talking about the various benefits of this open science concept and this movement. And I think one of the really positive things that we can put in there to kind of wrap up the conversation is that people in our field are kind of leading the charge there. And it definitely looks like there's going to be some progress made in the years to come. And there's some really, really smart, really solid people behind that organization. So should be good stuff on the horizon.
For sure.
A rare instance of Eric Trexler with the optimism.
Do we want to push forward, or is this just a fireside chat about open science?
Let's give the people something a little bit lighter. Let's skip right to the end and talk about our most hilarious gym fails.
Sure.
I feel like that would lighten the mood a bit.
Yeah, I can I can lead this one off.
Yeah, go for it.
So pretty early in my training career, I've talked about this on the podcast before, some of the folks I trained with were big time West Side guys, and that was my introduction to powerlifting. And these folks kind of took Louis's ideas and cranked them up to 13. So, you know, basically, like, max effort day was max effort day, dynamic effort day was max effort day, but with an enormous amount of band tension, and then you would like do the speed work. And they, you know, basically took what Louis said about, hey, bands are good for all of these various reasons. And the thinking was essentially, well, if bands are good, more bands must be better. So we used an ass load of band tension on pretty much everything. And so once upon a time, we were doing rack pulls. And we had just gobs and gobs of band tension. And I was, if memory serves, the only person in our group that pulled conventional. There was one other conventional puller, but he was like 5'5". So I was the only like average height person who pulled conventional. And so we were doing rack pulls, and I'm not just like height flexing right now. This will be relevant. We had, God, probably like 500-600 pounds of band tension on the bar, just like multiple doubled heavy bands. And it was like fairly high rack pulls as well. And so it wound up being like most people were working with like a 4-inch range of motion, and I was working with like an 8-inch range of motion. And as we were warming up, you know, we were doing reps, and the power rack we were working out of wasn't bolted down. And, you know, we were in like the actual cage part of the power rack, and there were weights on the back of the power rack, but obviously they weren't providing a counterbalance against a lifting force on the front of the rack. And so as we're warming up with all of this band tension, I did a rep, I stood at lockout for a second, realized like, wait a second, why is the bar continuing to feel lighter in my hands? And it's because like the band tension was sufficient, and I was just tall enough that it was like basically lifting the front of the rack up off the ground, like the tension of the bands pulling against it. And so like this was a big ass power rack, and it just tipped it backwards. There was a mirror behind the rack. It shattered the mirror. It was a cinder block wall. The rack was like tipping fast enough that it like pretty significantly chipped some of the cinder block. and then basically like the whole gym had to be rearranged for like 2 weeks to get the rack away from the wall so that repairs could be done on the wall. And then like the gym had to pay for another mirror, and like mirrors aren't cheap. And this was also like 5 p.m. So it was peak gym time. The whole thing was full. Like I was 14, maybe 15 at the time. So like I was the only like young teenager in there, and there's just like all of these adults glaring at me disapprovingly. And in hindsight, I'm not like that embarrassed about it, because I wasn't the person who decided to do like heavy tension block pull or heavy tension rack pulls. And like, it's not my fault that I was the only like average height conventional deadlifter in our group. It could have happened to anyone. But at the time, I was completely mortified. And that is far and away the most destructive gym fail I've ever had.
Yeah. So fortunately, my gym fail wasn't as destructive, but it definitely had the potential to be in terms of human cost. So, you know, if you ever like watch a documentary about like old rock stars and they're like, hey, what happened, you know, this particular event? And they go, well, it was the 80s and there was a lot of cocaine around. So my story goes back to the late 2000s and there were a lot of pre-workouts on the market. Dude, you remember the late 2000s? Every pre-workout was just like, what is the most intense pre-workout that we could make without killing someone?
Yeah, yeah.
Or with only killing a few people.
Yeah. Numbers were way more limited than the scaremongering mainstream media would lead you to believe.
Yeah.
It's not like gym goers were dropping dead left and right, but it's also not that gym goers weren't dropping dead.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, like, yeah, it was pretty messed up. But yeah, it was the late 2000s. Dude, I was obsessed with lifting at the time. It was the only thing that I actually was interested in or cared about. And yeah, so I was on the campus of a university. I don't want to get anybody fired, so I'll leave it vague which one. But I think they just forgot that there was this gym that existed in a basement of a dorm. There's no way they knew about it. There's no way. So like when I say a gym, I mean, you open the door and there's a bunch of free weights in there. There's no front desk. There's no staff. There's no check-in. It's just a room with a bunch of metal in it. And there were no windows, you know? So I went down there at like 2 or 3 in the morning and was just like, I got a lot of energy. I'm all hopped up on pre-workouts. Let's just go for it. And so it's like, you know, 3 a.m., no one around, no windows, in the basement of a building. No one could hear you scream. And dude, I just like pancaked myself with a 1 rep max bench.
Ooh.
Like with clips on the bar.
Ooh.
There was no tipping it. Like I probably, like, you know, not to be dramatic, I probably could have just rolled it down, but it was like a good 98% of my max that I just barely misgrooved, and I just got pancaked. And as I could feel this happening, I was like, you know, when I say pancaked, it was for a split second. Like, I was pinned. And I had the only genuine, honest-to-God fight-or-flight response that I've ever experienced in my life. And if you've never had a real one, it's wild. Like, I really believe that if there were twice the weight on that bar, I still would have got it. The intense fight-or-flight response, like, I was pinned, and then the bar was up. It was the wildest thing I've ever experienced. I've never experienced anything like it. So it was a potential gym fail. And then after it, I was like, what am I doing down here? Like, that could have been a really unpleasant night for me.
That, it's fucking scary, dog.
Yeah.
So I haven't had anything that scary happen. But I tore a pec doing some bench eccentrics, I believe with 495. So, you know, it was like super max, but not like crazy super max. Like I think my max at the time was like 465, give or take. But it was definitely more than I could push off of me. And it was definitely more than I could push off of me with a torn pec. And it was one of those like time dilating things where, you know, I feel the pec go, and I'm like, this is a problem.
Mm.
And then I stop to consider, I don't have a spotter. This is an even bigger problem. And like it felt like 30 seconds between when I could feel the pec let go and when I was just positive my impending demise was coming. And you may be listening to this and thinking, Greg, why were you doing eccentric bench without a spotter? It's because I had fucking pins up. Like, you know, I was just doing eccentrics to the pins. This was like my fourth set. I knew the fucking pins were there. But it was kind of like that same fight or flight response that you were talking about. If you've ever played a video game with bullet time mode, that's what I felt like I was in. Because it couldn't have been more than a quarter second between my pec letting go and the bar making contact with the pins. But that quarter second felt like it was a minute and a half. And I was like, I don't have a fucking will. Like, how long will it take for people to get here to pull this off of me? The music's really loud. If I scream, is anyone going to hear it? Like, there was enough time for all of those thoughts to go through my mind. And then it's like, clink, clink, when the bar hits the pins. And I felt so fucking stupid. But, like, I was shook. Like, I had a wild fight or flight response. Like, I went in the bathroom and my my pupils were like, my eyes were just completely black because my pupils were completely dilated. It was the craziest feeling.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, man. Well, I tell you what, we're probably about at the end here, right?
Yes, sir. So thank you for listening to this episode of the Stronger by Science Fireside Chat series. If you enjoyed it, leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're listening on YouTube, give us a thumbs up, drop a comment. That does help with traffic to some degree. If there are any questions that you'd like to hear us discuss in a fireside chat, or if there are any lifting questions you'd like to hear us discuss on a regular Stronger by Science podcast, if Eric ever wants to have me back as a temporary guest co-host, you can ask those at tiny.cc/SBSQA. And that's about it. Hope you are enjoying life, staying safe, and we will talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast. Now, Greg and I are not experts in medicine or health or really anything else for that matter. So before you make any changes to your diet and exercise habits, make sure you check with a doctor or another healthcare professional. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to support it, visit StrongerByScience.com to check out the products and services that we offer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with Millicue Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.